A few years ago, a lesbian couple in Kansas put an ad on Craigslist asking a man to donate sperm so they could have a child. Now, the man who did is being sued by the state for thousands in child support. I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we explore the legal conundrums, old and new, created by reproductive technology. With sperm and egg donations, surrogate parenting, fertility treatments, what responsibility do and should would-be parents have under the law? Later, we'll hear about a neo-Nazi group set to hold a rally in Kansas City this week. We'll hear from those who keep an eye on such organizations and talk about how locals hope to overcome hate. It's ahead on Central Standard, after the news. Gather round for the strange and sad case of William Murata. He answers a Craigslist ad from a couple looking for a sperm donor. They can't afford to use a licensed agency, but they offer Mr. Murata $50. He declines their money, but offers the donation, and they conceive and give birth to a child. But when the mother and child receive state assistance, Kansas wants to know who the baby's father is, and now the state wants to make him pay. Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Good to be back with you. It's a legal question, maybe a moral and ethical one, too. Who is responsible for children born through, say, non-traditional methods of conceiving? And Mr. Murata's situation is just the most recent case in what is a long and complicated history. What's a family or someone wanting a family to do? Later this hour, we'll talk about this Saturday's neo-Nazi rally planned for Kansas City and how communities can respond when hate comes to town. But first today, reproductive law and responsibility. Joining us is Karen Rosenberg. She's an attorney and partner at Kriegel & Kriegel in Kansas City, specializing in reproductive technology law and adoption law. Welcome to you, Karen.
Thank you.
And Chris Probasco, a licensed clinical social worker with Clinical Counseling Associates in Liberty and Overland Park. Chris, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you both. So let's start with this case. It's not the only thing we'll talk about today by any means, but this case has been in the news. A man apparently donated sperm out of the goodness of his heart to a couple that needed it. What did he do wrong, Karen?
First, I want to say that I'm not personally involved with the case. I don't represent any of the parties. There are sperm donation laws in the state of Kansas that if the law is followed, then the sperm donor is deemed by law not to be the father of the child. If the law is not followed, then you can wind up in a situation such as you've described.
So what did he do to not follow the law?
Well, the law says that if sperm is donated to a woman other than the sperm donor's wife, and the sperm is provided to a licensed physician, then the sperm donor is deemed not to be the father of the child, unless a written agreement is entered otherwise.
They did sign some paperwork, I understand, in this case, but the state of Kansas is not recognizing that because it wasn't done through a physician.
And that's my understanding also.
How typical is a case like this? Is there a lot of gray area in reproductive technology law these days?
Sperm donation laws, both in Kansas and Missouri, have been around for a while. But when you get into other areas, such as gestational carrier situations and egg donors, those situations are not specifically addressed by Missouri and Kansas law.
We'll talk about all of those cases, surrogate parenting, adoption, embryo adoption, some of those issues today. But I do want to ask you, Chris Probasco, as a social worker, as a counselor, part of what happened in the case that's been in the news is that you had a couple who apparently couldn't afford to go through those more traditional or those more legally recognized means. How expensive is it for a couple who wants to conceive through artificial insemination?
Well, if they choose a known donor, then usually there's not a charge for the donor, but there is charges for the reproductive endocrinologist. And in this case, either Karen or I or both of us would have been referred, and we would have done counseling and figured out what was best for the child that would have been born from this situation.
Are those kinds of expenses covered by insurance typically for either the families wanting to have a child or those who are willing to donate to help them?
Typically not. Some of the coverage of medical procedures and diagnostic testing could be covered by insurance, but typically not. And it is probably about a $5,000 expense to go forward. However, the safety of a child for a lifetime is worth it. And for this particular couple, maybe they needed to wait a year and save money and try to figure out what would be best for the child.
Right. There are some other issues about readiness to support the child once the child is born, too.
Of course.
Before we move away from that case completely, Karen, I know you said you're not involved in this particular one, but how do you or other legal experts imagine the judge would rule on this case?
That's a difficult question to answer. It depends on if the judge is going to strictly apply the Kansas law, and if the judge applies the Kansas sperm donation law strictly, then steps have not been taken to terminate the parental rights of the sperm donor.
So we'll have to wait and see.
Exactly.
And we are waiting. The district court judge just heard arguments on Friday in the case, and we don't know exactly when the decision will come. Let me ask you, Karen, more broadly, are there some key legal principles or questions in the area of law around all of these issues that always sort of these cases come back to the same questions over and over?
There are, and depending on the type of arrangement, you're discussing different issues arise, for example, with gestational carrier situations where a woman agrees to carry an embryo to term and she's not the genetic mother of the child.
So we might call that surrogate?
Correct. Mothering? Some people do.
Okay.
There are really two parts to the legal process involved. The intended parents need to enter an agreement with their gestational carrier and her husband if she's married, setting forth clearly what their intents and purposes are with the arrangement. And then if they're successful in achieving a pregnancy and a child's born, there's a legal action that needs to be filed to determine parentage of the child.
You know, we hear these cases where agreements have been made, papers have been signed, but then the surrogate mother wants to keep the child, or someone who was genetically part of the child's parenting but was not going to be raising the child says they've changed their mind. How does the law handle those cases?
Well, in reality, I think those situations appear more on TV than they do in reality. And part of the pieces of the arrangement need to be meeting with somebody like Chris, who counsels all the parties involved before even entering the legal arrangement.
So, Chris, when someone comes to you and says, we're thinking of asking someone to help us have a child, whether through carrying the child for them or through donating egg or sperm, what do you need to talk with them about? What's in their head that you need to help them sort out?
Well, generally, we start out with their mission to have a child and all the experiences that's taken place. And we do focus on the grief that's involved because they weren't successful to bring a child by what we consider normal means, if there is such a thing these days. But we would evaluate their choice of the potential gestational family. I would also meet with the gestational family, the woman and her husband, and then I meet with all of them together, and we go over all the medical, physical, psychological, emotional, spiritual ways that they would be affected by this decision. We also pay careful attention to the gestational carrier's family. And especially if they're parenting children, not everybody's mother has a baby and they don't bring them home. So we want to make sure that their family's prepared. I call them early babysitters, that they're caring for the child until they're able to go home to their parents.
Is there something that you do in the way you talk about this with families that keeps it from feeling quite like such a transaction, like such a commodification of of the life involved, the buying or selling of life?
Well, I come from the social and emotional viewpoint, so I think it's a little bit easier not to focus on the contracts. That's something that Karen does very successfully.
I mean, even emotionally. I mean, it does feel like, you know, we've made an arrangement, and this baby that's been carried in someone else is now going to be part of our family, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely an alternative choice. It's not the first choice, and we try to make it as normal as possible. So hopefully by the time they're successful with a pregnancy, this becomes their normal and their way of bringing a child in. And they feel very proud of all the work that went into the decision and the outcome.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, KCUR. We're streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we're talking about the challenges and responsibilities that come from non-traditional, we might say, conception, things like sperm and egg donation or other gestational carriers. If you're thinking of becoming a parent through some means other than traditional conception, we'd love to hear from you. Or maybe you've tried and found yourself running into legal or financial or emotional roadblocks. Give us a call with your questions or your comments at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And if you'd rather be not quite so public, you can also reach us by email by writing to centralstandard@kcur.org. Been using the term gestational carriers, and I asked if we also call that surrogate parenting. Why the change in terminology? Karen?
We refer to it now as gestational carrier if the woman who's giving birth to the child does not have a genetic connection to the child. And I think part of that has evolved from getting away from the maybe the old notions of that the woman who gives birth to a child is the child's mother, with the different situations that have now developed. A child can actually have several different mothers, depending on how mother is defined.
Okay, so how typically would a couple that wants to have a child go about finding a gestational carrier for their child?
With the known gestational carriers that I've been working with, it's really friends and cousins and sisters and old college roommate. You know, they put out the word that they're in this situation and they would like to talk with anyone that would consider carrying a child for them. There are organizations that recruit women to become gestational carriers. If you go on the internet, they're all over it, all over. However, that type of arrangement could run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars by the time you pay everybody, the broker, the facilitator, as well as the surrogate.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars. So really a very small portion of the population has this option available to them if they're going with a not known carrier.
Correct. And I think that's why a lot of people choose a known situation. We find this in private adoption as well. We talk to our clients about spread the word that you're interested in adopting, and maybe your best friend's next door neighbor's girlfriend's daughter is pregnant, and you can connect to adoption that way.
Karen, how deeply regulated is all of this, or is it kind of a wide open Wild West market?
Well, there aren't specific laws in Kansas and Missouri that address gestational carrier arrangements or egg donation arrangements. So I wouldn't say it's just a Wild West, but there do need to be precautions put in place. For example, receiving the medical clearance from the physician who will do the proceedings, having all the parties meet with Chris or someone like Chris to make sure that everybody is emotionally and psychologically ready to proceed. And from the legal perspective, we really don't get involved until those pieces have been put into place.
That's Karen Rosenberg. She's an attorney at Kriegel & Kriegel here in town. Chris Probasco is a licensed clinical social worker, and they both work on adoption and other non-traditional ways of people coming to have children and families. Let's take a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888, a caller who's asking us not to use her name, from Lee's Summit. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. just wanted to call, and I am the recipient of a donor egg. My husband and I are. And for age issues, we had to use a donor egg. And it's the most wonderful thing. We have a beautiful child. And there are times that I wish that I could meet the donor, or I wish I could just say thank you to her for the gift that she's given us.
Thank you so much for sharing that call. And so you, do you feel comfortable telling us where did you go to find the donor for the egg?
It was through our doctor's office. We went to a reproductive specialist here in the Kansas City area, and they provided us with a donor, and we could say yes or no, and
based on just a description of the donor.
Yes, it had her picture. It had other children that she had.
Okay.
Her own children, and it had height, weight, education, religious background, any medical issues that she could have had, or that ran in her family.
And how old's your child now?
He is 5.
Oh, great. Well, congratulations. I'm glad it worked out so well for you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So how typical is that story from Lee's Summit? Go to the doctor, ask for a donor, try to choose one. Everything works out great. Chris?
Well, with egg donors, there's several ways that one can connect. We've talked about the known way. There's also reproductive endocrinologists that have donor programs in their practice. And then there's also national programs that recruit egg donors. I work with one program in town where I evaluate the potential egg donors that are going into his program. And there's a lot of work put into making sure that this is the best possibility for the child that will result.
What kind of counseling does an egg donor get in this situation? Do they get any?
Yes, I spend at least a couple hours with them. I go over all their family history. They fill out 8 pages of information for me, and we go into the motivation for wanting to do this, the understanding that forevermore they will be genetically connected to that child, and how they see that responsibility playing out on the long haul. I'm a real proponent of these kind of arrangements, signing up with the donor sibling registry. So right away, they have a way to contact each other if there's any medical need for the child. Mm. One of the problems with getting medical information, it's wonderful, wonderful, but it's frozen in time. So we don't know if a year from when that information was given, if the donor's mother suffered from ovarian cancer and died at age 37. You know, those families need to know that information to be as much of an advocate for the child as possible.
Yeah, Karen?
And adding on to what Chris said, from the legal perspective, when the intended parents enter the contract or agreement with their egg donor, we like to include a provision that the egg donor will keep the intended parents informed if some medical issue should arise at a later date, either with her or some another child that she might have.
Right. What kind of things might keep someone from being a donor, an egg donor?
Well, by the time I see them, they've already gone through a medical screening. So they've looked at their medical history and all the contagious diseases and such.
Sure. But besides medical, I mean, are there other reasons?
There's social reasons. If a woman is married and her husband won't come in with her, that's a big red flag. If she's doing this purely for the money, then she's at risk for carrying through with all the medical appointments. So the motivation, I think, needs to have an altruistic reason also with that. Her education background is examined. Her relationship with her families, if there's any stressors in her life, if there's any legal issues that are going on. We want to make sure when she goes through the process that she understands all the medical and physical aspects. She will have over 52 shots that she takes in stimulating her ovaries, so not everybody is prepared for that or understands what that will all mean for their body. So there's an in-depth interview by the clinic, paperwork reviewed, and then also by myself.
And do you ever have someone who decides not to proceed after the counseling? I mean, after you've talked with them, do they rethink their decision?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And you'd consider that a good outcome?
I do. That's a positive outcome. I don't want anyone to enter into this agreement if they're not fully acknowledge the issues. And sometimes the issues are just more than what they can handle. And one of my more recent cases is I had a woman that had two children and her husband wouldn't come in, so that's another red flag. And she had no thinking about her children being genetically connected to the children that she would help create through an egg donation. And so it was kind of like a deer in the headlight kind of moment for her of, oh my gosh.
They're going to have brothers and sisters they don't know.
Correct.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Karen, about something you said earlier, that there are laws about sperm donation, but there really aren't many laws about egg donation. Why is that?
You know, that's correct. There are a few states that do have laws that directly address egg donation. Missouri and Kansas don't have those laws. I don't know if it's just not a priority for the legislatures, and we make the situations fit the legal framework that is already in place for determining parentage of a child and also adoption.
Yeah. It occurs to me that those worlds are very different. Egg donation obviously is a more intrusive procedure, involves obviously asks more of the woman making the donation than sperm donation asks of the man.
Correct. And that is absolutely correct. There are men who regularly donate sperm. I don't think there are women who could even physically regularly donate their eggs.
Right. I wonder also, we've talked a little bit about just surrogate parenting or gestational carriers. We've talked about egg and sperm donation. But another area that is maybe a growing part of the law and of practice is embryo adoption. What is embryo adoption, Karen?
It's embryo adoption is really a term of art. Legally, you can't adopt a child until the child is born. But what happens with an embryo donation arrangement is a couple or an individual may have embryos that are left from an IVF procedure, and they decide that their family is complete, and they make the choice to donate their embryos onto a third party so that party can achieve a pregnancy and have a child.
This is really exciting aspect of adoption and probably the one that I focus on most now. I've been doing this for 42 years, so now I'm in embryo adoption. The advantage is that the mother that gives can give birth to her own adopted child. Of course, that's a huge advantage for the mother. But we do treat it as an adoption. We do an adoptive parent home study for the intended parents. There's counseling also for the embryo donor. And once a baby is born, then there's a court process where the parents actually receive an adoption decree. So they are giving birth to a child that is not genetically connected to them. And that is, in my mind, and I believe Karen's also, an adoption process.
816-235-2888 is the number to call to talk about reproductive technology law and responsibility. Kenda is calling from Platte City. Kenda, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
So tell us a little of your story.
I was the second, as far as we know, as far as we were told, woman to give birth to a baby that was not legally mine. She'll be 27 in the spring. So I was an in vitro surrogate. The organization that helped us come together was called the Hagar Institute. They were in Topeka, Kansas. And she'll be 27 in the spring, and she's a nurse.
Wow. And how, I guess, as you sort of follow the news and you pay attention to how this works, how was it different 30 years ago?
The technology was not what it is today. The couple had to take out a loan to do this. And at the time, I said that I was only willing to be an in vitro surrogate. I was not willing to donate my genetic self to this project. So they were very possibly going to go into it, spend all the money and the time and the emotion, and possibly end up with no baby. So they had already decided that they would budget for 3 attempts. It was our 3rd attempt that was successful. And it turned out to be really great. Legally, this was during the time when Mary Beth Whitehead was coming to the fore, and people were anxious and nervous. She was a blood surrogate who changed her mind during the pregnancy, and there was a big fight. So it was also emotionally that family putting themselves out on the limb for hope, and it all turned out great.
Kenda, I really appreciate you sharing your story. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you. I appreciate telling it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So how typical is that story? I mean, 27 years old that child is now. She was one of the first.
Well, you know, surrogacy dates back to the Bible, so it's been present in our society since documentation there. And there was casual surrogate arrangements where there would be an at-home insemination for a friend, and they would become pregnant and then give birth and transfer the child physically, but there wouldn't be any legal aspects or social aspects of attention. We live in a much different world today, and we need to protect children that come from this process, and the best is to have prepared parents and gone through a social situation, emotional, and also legal.
Karen, living here in the Kansas City metro area, is it different here than it would be if either the donors or the parents or those who want to be parents, if they lived on a coast, legally or culturally, is anything different about being here?
From the legal perspective, it really depends on usually where the child will be born, where, as you stated, the intended parents live. I do think that it has become much more commonplace here in the Midwest, and that there are more people pursuing building their family through these alternative methods.
And Chris, when you talk with folks, is that your sense as well?
Yes, that's my sense. And I think one of the reasons that we see more couples choosing reproductive technology is that the adoption options for couple are more restricted. Internationally, we really don't have very many children coming home. In 2012, there was only 8,700 children came home internationally. And in private adoption, less than 30,000 children were placed in infant adoptions, compared to, we believe, over 60,000 children are born by some form of donation, egg, sperm, or embryo placement a year. So we're really outdoing our fellow adoption companions.
If you had any advice, if there are people listening today who are intended parents, who want to be parents, and they're thinking about pursuing one of these courses of having children, what advice would you give them right now? What are two or three things they need to be thinking about? Legally or emotionally and psychologically?
They need to be working with a reproductive endocrinologist, and there's several practices in the area. If they're just exploring this issue, trying to figure out some of the life consequences for them and their family, their religious background, then I would think coming in for counseling a few times to figure that if this is a good decision would be helpful. And I think also maybe having a consultation with Karen or another attorney about what does this really mean legally, so they have all of their pieces as much as they can together to make a really good decision. The child deserves that.
Yeah. Karen?
And I would add to that too, just to caution people about using the internet. Just like anything else in life, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And there are numerous websites out there now offering to match intended parents with a donor or a gestational carrier. And as Chris stated, getting counseling, talking to your physician, talking to an attorney who's knowledgeable in this area are the best ways to proceed.
Let's take one more call here from Pam in Greeley, Kansas. Pam, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just curious about how medical insurance plays into gestational carriers and egg donors and things like that. From personal experience, my husband and I and a friend of ours were considering going down that route. One of my longtime girlfriends had offered to carry a baby for us, and that was just a question we never resolved at the time, and ultimately we decided to adopt internationally, but just wondering if your guests have any insight into how that played out.
Sure. Appreciate that question, Pam. And let me tack on a question from one of our listeners on the email who asked, can you ask the guests to speak to costs and legal risks surrounding using a gestational carrier who is a friend? Are there risks associated with that if they are known to you, especially knowing that it could cost thousands and thousands of dollars? Karen?
Those are good questions, and that's exactly part of the process when you begin and when you enter the legal contract with your gestational carrier. One of the aspects of the agreement does cover medical insurance. It's important to review the gestational carrier's insurance policy to determine if there is a specific exclusion for a gestational carrier pregnancy. And those are exactly the things that need to be addressed. As far as entering a situation with a friend, from the legal standpoint, we treat that as if the parties are not acquainted, and the same type of agreement needs to be entered at the beginning of the process.
So how I treat that case is that we're crossing boundaries because we usually don't have our friends involved intimately in our private life, and carrying mm-hmm. a child and donating an egg certainly is that. And then we look at exploring how this friendship will maintain during the donation process or the pregnancy process and what it would look like potentially for the children in both families.
One more question to you. What is there a next frontier? We wouldn't have dreamed of IVF before 20, 30 years ago, or maybe 40 years ago. We wouldn't have dreamed of some of the options that are available to families today. What's next in reproductive technology? Anything on the horizon that we aren't currently thinking about?
Well, there's a lot of longitudinal studies that are going on about the environmental effect on fertility, the hormones in our food and how that may be affecting our fertility. There's also studies on genetic incompatibility for some couples. They're just not able to make a child together because of genetics. I think, genetics, DNA, and all of that is definitely in our future to explore. I hope we just don't lose sight of we are creating a child for a family. This isn't a commodity. This isn't someone that we can just desire and not think about what their needs are. IVF started in 1978. Mary Louise Brown is in her mid-30s, and there's been 5 million babies born throughout the world since this time. So obviously it was an event that was very successful, and we'll have some more.
And legally, Karen, anything on the horizon in this area of law?
Not that I'm aware of, and from the legal perspective, it does make this area of the law fascinating and exciting to practice in, because we need to make fit legally what medically can be done now.
Well, we'll leave it there. Karen Rosenberg is an attorney specializing in reproductive technology law, adoption law, partner at Kriegel & Kriegel in Kansas City. Karen, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Probasco is a licensed clinical social worker with Clinical Counseling Associates here in town. Thank you for being here, Chris.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, a look at this Saturday's rally planned by the National Socialist Movement, a neo-Nazi group for here in Kansas City. The organizers say they expect 1,000 people. What's this group about? And how can the community respond to hate groups in ways that protect and strengthen the community? Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR.